From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This week, a show about media and space. Remember way back to, say, 1998, when the most popular medium for old and young alike was television, and when the most popular place to consume it was your living room? Today, you're as likely to be at a desk or a Starbucks as your easy chair. Advances in both technology and design have altered both how and where you get the news. So this week, we decided to focus on the where.
If this seems a bit abstract, well, we used to feel that way, but now we don't. WNYC, the nation's largest public radio station and where On the Media is produced, is moving. Ever since the 1920s, when New York Public Radio was founded, WNYC has lived in the iconic municipal building in the City Hall district of Lower Manhattan. Now we're moving on up to the western edge of trendy Soho. State-of-the-art studios, triple the square footage, three full floors of open-plan offices. A brand new space.
Which got us thinking about some other spaces. So we thought we would rerun some prior considerations of media spaces and also report on some new ones, including how architects use high-tech technology to pitch their designs and how sound is used to create and modify spaces. First, though, Japan's bid for the extreme media experience offered via so-called media immersion pods. I say so-called because the Japanese just called them internet cafes or manga cafes after the illustrated books. But they are so much more.
Internet cafes are to these immersion pods what a Hershey bar is to a bathtub full of molten Godiva. Virginia Heffernan wrote about the ultimate media indulgence in the New York Times. She admitted that it felt a little decadent.
And there's something even a little bit disreputable about these places. They are kept pretty dark, and they also have a smoking section, which in a room of cubicles translates into a general scent of smoke that pervades the whole. And I'm guessing it's about 40,000 square feet. So
an airplane hangar?
Yeah, an airplane hangar. That's about right. They're windowless with almost like mood lighting over certain stations that offer you drinks. And then there are different sections in the room. So there's a place for women, which is pretty significant because the media immersion pods have become one of the few places that women of all ages can go that's semi-public where they can also just be alone. I heard a lot of descriptions by married women of saying, when I want to be away from my husband, I go to these places and sometimes stay all night in the ladies section.
Now, how do you stay all night? I mean, you're sitting in a chair, right?
Well, that brings us to what the inside of the Carrolls look like. Really soft bucket leather seats, a terrific PlayStation, a great Xbox, Nintendo Wii, a DVD player, a high-speed internet connection. And then there are spaces, like a place for you to put your feet up if you just want to turn the chair a little bit and simply read, which surprisingly is what a lot of people do in these places. So you're in front of all this high-tech, high-speed, expensive technology, which cuts down on the feeling that this is a somehow cheap or tawdry experience.
So how long did you stay when you went?
I think I stayed for a total of 6 or 7 hours. Like a casino, you enter and your sense of time goes out the window. I mean, I couldn't believe when I looked at my watch and it was maybe almost dawn.
If these are fundamentally, I won't say antisocial, but non-social experiences, how do people account for the fact that other people are right with them?
Well, one of my questions when I was in there is, would these things exist if people weren't on networked computers? So, yes, people are not talking to people at the juice stations. They're not talking over the walls of their cubicles. So to that extent, they're alone. But there is a lot of instant messaging, text messaging, emailing going on, and that strange sense that we've now gotten used to of being alone and yet very socially involved with the world via cyberspace. You come to this so that you can be at the cockpit and you can like pilot through the internet or through cyberspace and be fully in control from this position. So I didn't feel that it was a reclusive place as much as a place of power.
In the U.S., we often think of people who don't interact with other people in the physical world as troubled. Does a similar stigma exist in Japan?
There are certainly extreme cases, and they get a lot of attention, of the so-called hikikomori, who are...
They're the shut-ins.
They're shut-ins, yeah. They're young men, mostly. There are very few women who essentially enter their room, and they're usually living with their parents at the time, and in the ideology of Japan, have decided that the burdens on them as wage earners are just too high, or as students are too high, and that they're just not coming out. And I think that that fantasy of shutting yourself in your room, as opposed maybe to an American fantasy of running away, is to some extent present for all young Japanese.
Well, all teenagers shut themselves in their room at one point or another, all around the world, if they have a room.
Yeah.
But in Japan, you note examples where sometimes they shut themselves away for years, one person for 13 years.
Yeah. Maggie Jones did a wonderful story for the New York Times Magazine on this phenomenon of the hikikomori. And one of the things that seems clear is that in America, when I as an adolescent locked myself in my room, the thing that got me out of it was thinking, but I still have to meet other kids. Well, if you can lock yourself in your room and still meet other kids online, and moreover, and this is a sort of later stage development in Japan, become famous online, there are these amazing figures who are known as the charisma hiki, who are shut-ins with a following. So their mothers believe them to be languishing in their room as if in prison, but their throngs of followers believe them to be sort of celebrities or gods or rock stars.
Are Japanese and American culture similar enough that you would or could expect these media immersion pods to spring up here in our cities?
Everyone who read the piece said, you know, it's sick, but I wish I could go into a media immersion pod.
We do seem to be potentially creating things like that for our own homes. I mean, it used to be that TV used to be the center of a communal experience. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore now that we're consuming our media in a different way.
One hypothesis about media has it that suburban architecture after the war was very much about encouraging family and about discouraging solitude on the part of either the man or the woman. So there weren't the same sewing rooms or watercolor rooms for the women, and there weren't the same smoking rooms and studies for the men. And instead, they had dens, TV rooms, family rooms. Well, in reaction, you get real hi-fi culture and audiophile culture. And also these chairs that start to be womb-like, where men almost want to create, I keep saying men because audiophiles are almost exclusively male, trying to create a space almost in their bodies. You know, maybe my head can take this in, and then if I put the newspaper in front of my face, and then I can start to like create a little four walls that will just exempt me from family activities and family responsibilities.
Even while they're sitting perhaps in the middle of it.
Even while they're sitting perhaps in the middle of it. So the 70s dad with his huge headphones plugged in and listening to something else, he just gets to not be there. I mean, I use my BlackBerry this way too, to just put a little barrier, create a little actual physical space for myself in public.
But is audiophile dad, who had to live inside his own head, getting replaced by home theater dad?
The home theaters definitely among the wealthy are making a comeback. And you might justify to your spouse that you need a, quote, home office, but then that can quickly turn into an entertainment center.
With four walls and a door.
With actual four walls and a door. But just as the spaces seem like they're as much a sanctuary as possible, then you start to see in the magazines that chronicle how these interiors change. Instead of the one Ames chair, it's suddenly two chairs, because what if you want your buddy to come over and watch with you? And then like five chairs, because you want to be the person that can have the Super Bowl party or the Oscars party if you have that good technology. And then it just starts to look like you've set up a little movie theater in your house. Like you almost should be charging tickets for it.
Getting back to Japan for a moment, we always think about immersing ourselves in media as a way to lose ourselves. But someone in your story said that at least in Japan, these pods are constructed and inhabited and used as a way to find oneself.
Yeah, Japanese society and American society too, during the workday and in formal workplaces, are so stratified. And the same is true at school. These spaces in Japan, these immersion pods, are a place to go in. I think that the anthropologist I spoke to said something like, you turn into no ID man, no face man, no name man. And that for him, opened up a world of possibilities, he thought, for young people and middle-aged people who go into these immersion pods, maybe under the pretext of doing some work or checking some email or checking stock prices, but actually get to do a little bit of role play while they're there, or a little just fantasy escape. Part of the reason I think that it's worth building these studies or letting your spouse have a home office where they do a lot of fantasy football and maybe not as much work as they're pretending they're doing is that everyone has always needed fictional getaways, and they've needed a place to immerse themselves in a sort of unreal space.
I wonder whether it's a problem simply of definition. Whenever we talk about people getting over-engaged in a mental space, in a virtual space, we think it's sick. I mean, I hear people talk about Second Life as if it were sick.
Yeah.
But then you read the stories about people whose actual lives are just no fun at all. And it's really time that we live in, not space. So why can't these virtual mental spaces be regarded as legitimate spaces, the same as spending time in the garden?
Yeah. I mean, I think that as much as now we pay lip service to how much we loved the golden age of the novel, we've never really liked the specter of the person who sits in some Cervantes world and reads long novels, or the moviegoer who comes out blinking against the light after, you know, a long double feature. And yet we believe now, nostalgically, that there was something that was good for you about reading novels. There was something that was good for you about seeing movies. And yet Second Life and the internet represent an addiction. I think the truth is we just always feel suspicious of these sedentary fantasy experiences.
Things that take you out of the real world.
Things that take you out of the real world.
Spaces in your head.
Spaces in your head. You're not meeting your obligations to your family or to your workplace if you're just lost in your head. And that makes you a threatening citizen.
Virginia, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Virginia Heffernan writes the Medium column for the New York Times Magazine, and she also blogs at themedium.blogs.nytimes.com.
Coming up, old media in new spaces, and how digital technology renders old-fashioned bricks and mortar.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Back with a special On the Media, our show this week about space. The quintessential nexus of media and interior space is, you might say, the newsroom. As we mentioned earlier, WNYC, where On the Media is produced, is currently relocating and expanding its newsroom. So we have grappled with this very issue of how to best arrange our own space. And so, too, have a host of other media organizations that are trying to integrate the centuries-old practice of journalism with 21st-century technology. Paul Goldberger is architecture critic for The New Yorker, where he wrote about two new buildings, that of The New York Times and Bloomberg LP, with two very different approaches. Paul, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks, Bob.
Before we talk about these new structures, let's get a sense of the classic newsroom.
Absolutely. There was the old linotypers. Actually, they were on the floor above, as I remember. And then the presses were down in the basement way below. So the writers and porters were actually kind of a sandwich in the middle of the whole production. And of course, it was all paper, too, because other than the telephone, that was the only way any information was conveyed. And copy boys were called copy boys because they ran around with copies of things.
It was kind of assembly line.
It was an assembly line because copy moved literally from your desk, if you were a reporter, to the editor who would first review it, to the copy desk that would review it for punctuation and comma and clarity and all that, up to the top editors who would review things again sort of for content, and then finally the piece of paper would be literally handed to a linotype operator who would set type for it. The open newsroom served two purposes. First, to help speed up this flow of pieces of paper on this assembly line. It was also to allow the editors to see everybody and to allow everybody to see everybody else. This sense that the shared energy in the room would keep everybody moving quickly. So there was a kind of work ethic to the old newsroom as well.
Okay, so let's fast forward to the new New York Times building. You said it has a tensile elegance, which got me to thinking about the Verrazano Narrows Bridge.
Right.
What did you have in mind?
Well, the new New York Times building is actually quite a beautiful skyscraper, very much at odds with the old image of a newspaper building, which was sort of tough and solid and hard and rough almost. It's very refined. It's a metal and glass building with beautiful sort of screen-like facades that help filter out the bright sun. The problem with it isn't the building itself. It's that once the time came to actually design the new newsroom inside this, the New York Times then kind of lost its nerve in a strange way and hired a very conventional architectural firm to do the interiors, a kind of dulled down, slowed down, big open space that loses the energy of the old newsroom but doesn't join it to anything else. And to me, most troubling was there really isn't anything that tells you it's the digital age other than this real silence through it all. You know, it's carpeted, and of course there are no typewriters. There haven't been typewriters for 20-plus years now. But there's nothing to sort of make up for all of that stuff.
Okay, well, let's move on to the Bloomberg building, which you say is a very different experience. Tell me about it.
Well, Bloomberg space is probably the most exciting newsroom of our time. It's a big, lively, colorful, energetic space, but it's an energy of a digital age. It's got flat screens all over the place, suspended from the ceiling. It's got constant information feeds on those flat screens. All the desks are sleek and white and tightly together. The place also, by the way, has a lot of very interesting contemporary art, which isn't part of the news gathering function, but adds to this sense of it being of the moment. There's a huge central, they call it the piazza. It's a kind of open place to sit and talk, get a snack, run into people. And you feel really that it has two parents, this space. One of them is the old newsroom, which of course it owes a debt to. The other is the trading floor. The Bloomberg newsroom kind of merges these two.
So when I read your piece in The New Yorker, one of the thoughts that I couldn't get out of my head was that the newspaper business is in a tailspin, and most of the rest of the media industry, you know, pretty wobbly too. And here are these two august organizations in new digs that cost, you know, $35 quintrillion each. And mm-hmm. I'm wondering what I'm supposed to make of that.
Well, the problem there is not extravagance so much as the lack of a clear idea of what to do. That's really what you feel at the New York Times. And the strange, quiet, elegant dullness of that newsroom does seem to me to embody the deer in the headlights. Then you go to Bloomberg and you feel that this is a place that knows exactly what it wants and knows exactly how to make a place for itself in this new media age.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Paul Goldberger is the architecture critic for The New Yorker, where he writes the Skyline column. His most recent book is Up From Zero, Politics, Architecture, and the Rebuilding of New York.
The Bloomberg Tower was completed in 2005. The New York Times Tower was completed in 2007. In their planning stages, they were each depicted in complex renderings available for view online, intended to show how they would fit in with their surroundings. These virtual constructions, designed for marketing purposes, have no real utility in construction, but they can mean everything to big-name architects called Starkitects and newcomers alike. Jeff Mano is senior editor at Dwell magazine. He says that architects are waking up to the fact that if you can post a sexy rendering of some building that may never be made online, you can increase the likelihood that it actually will be made.
Suddenly people are going to want to see that building. They're going to want to see it happen in the way that when you see a preview come up on the internet for a movie that doesn't come out till next summer, you're sort of building up hype. I mean, the rendering software that architects are now using do produce renderings that are almost hypnotic. You could look at buildings that don't exist for hours because they're so beautiful. And there's a lot of software that is actually crisscrossing back and forth between architecture and special effects industries, especially in Hollywood, where the exact same software that people use to model, say, explosions or CGI for the film Iron Man, that same software package is now being used by architecture firms. And so the new public appeal of architecture is almost entirely visual.
And you talk about buildings that don't yet exist. You may also be talking about buildings that can't exist. There's been some controversy over some of these renderings where the trees and the scale and so much of it simply doesn't reflect the kind of environment it's going to be in or could be in. And if you show an aerial rendering, it seems to reduce its imprint on the surrounding environment.
The way I sort of describe it is that they're almost like science fiction stories, that it's a way of presenting the world so that it looks vaguely the same, but there's something not quite right. And that's that you have added a building or an entire complex of buildings or an entire city to the skyline. And so you're dealing with a kind of collective fantasy that you're presenting a view of the world as it may exist. You're not trying to reflect the world as it is. A good analogy, though, is to stick with this film idea, which is that a rendering produced by an architecture firm is very much like the description of a film that a director would give you. I mean, if Steven Spielberg says that, you know, he's just directed the greatest action film of all time with nonstop laughs and it's fun for the whole family, you're not going to just post that onto your blog and say, oh, this is the film coming out from Steven Spielberg. You're going to question that a little bit.
Or when Wolf says that CNN has the best political team on television.
Yeah, that's Wolf's rendering of CNN, as it were. So, I mean, that's really all an architect is doing. They're just presenting literally the best looking image they possibly can of their building. And they're doing it not only as a standalone artwork, but they're doing it as an act of persuasion.
Are there any telltale signs that a rendering is out to manipulate you?
To be honest, I mean, the very act of it being a rendering is sort of inherently out to mislead you in the sense that that's kind of the point. You know, there was a time where producing renderings was almost irrelevant. I found quite frequently that when you get in touch with an architect because you're interested in a certain project that they're doing, that they don't even have renderings of it. They have floor plans or they have sections or they have other forms of project documentation that are actually useful for constructors or useful for the contractor or for developers or for the people that are going to move in. But the rendering as a kind of unified floor-to-ceiling visual image of architecture isn't even something that is necessary in order to grasp a project.
You say that these renderings aren't the best way to penetrate to the truth of an architectural idea. But in the movies, you always have that scene of the master builder standing in front of his, you know, 3D design.
There's the scene in Die Hard where the German terrorists have seized the Nakatomi building in Century City, Los Angeles. And they sit down with the head of the Nakatomi Corporation, and they're at a table that's covered in models. Models of all these high-rise buildings that this corporation wants to build all over the world.
And when Alexander saw the breadth of his domain, he wept, for there were no more worlds to conquer. Oh, that's beautiful. I always enjoyed to make models when I was a boy. The exactness, the attention to every conceivable detail. It's beautiful.
There's this kind of idea that architects are all sort of power mad and that, you know, urban planners, architects, military generals sort of lurk in a dark room hovering over an architectural model, spying on the city that they want to take over. There are famous photographs of Saddam Hussein pointing down at architecture models of the Baghdad to come that, you know, obviously he never had a chance to build, or of Hitler and his architect Albert Speer looking down at their plans for Germania, which was going to be, you know, Berlin 2.0, this gigantic city of marble statuary and huge capital domes. The model of this kind of future city or future architecture is definitely something that is supposed to bring out the power mad or bring out hubris or ambition in people who gaze upon it.
Jeff, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Jeff Mano blogs about architectural conjecture, urban speculation, and landscape futures at buildingblog.blogspot.com and is an editor at Dwell Magazine.
So if cutting-edge video technology can be used to sell buildings, then buildings can be used to sell everything else. At least that's what they used to do in São Paulo, Brazil. The city stood as a monument to visual pollution where no view was unobstructed by an advertising pitch. Then, on January 1st, 2007, a funny thing happened in this city of approximately 11 million people. The citizens awoke to find a ban on public advertising. Every billboard, every neon sign, every bus kiosk ad, and even the Goodyear blimp were suddenly illegal. Vinicius Galvão is a reporter for Folha de São Paulo, Brazil's largest newspaper. When we spoke to him in April of last year, he described how the city looked in the days before the advertising ban.
São Paulo is a very vertical city. That makes it very frenetic. You couldn't even realize the architecture of the old buildings because all the buildings, all the houses were just covered with billboards and logos and propaganda, and there was no criteria. And now it's amazing. They uncovered a lot of problems the city had that we never realized. For example, there are some favelas, which are the shanty towns. I wrote a big story in my newspaper today that in a lot of parts of the city, we never realized there was a big shanty town. People were shocked because they never saw that before, just because there was a lot of billboards covering the area.
No writer could have come up with a more vivid metaphor. What else has been discovered as the scales have fallen off of the city's eyes?
São Paulo is just like New York. It's a very international city. We have the Japanese neighborhood, we have the Korean neighborhood, we have the Italian neighborhood. And in the Korean neighborhood, they have a lot of small manufacturers, these Korean businessmen. They hire illegal labor from Bolivian immigrants. And there was a lot of billboards in front of these manufacturer shops. And when they uncovered, we could see through the window a lot of Bolivian people like sleeping and working at the same place. They earn money just enough for food. So it's another social problem that was uncovered. The city was shocked at this news.
I want to ask you about the cultural life of the city. Because like them or not, billboards and logos and bright lights create some of the vibrancy that a city has to offer. Isn't it weird walking through the streets with all of those images just absent?
No, it's weird because you get lost, so you don't have any references anymore. That's what I realized as a citizen. My reference was a big Panasonic billboard. But now my reference is Art Deco building that was covered through this Panasonic. So you start getting new references in the cities. The cities get now new language, a new identity.
Well, cleaning up the city is all well and good, but how do businesses announce to the public that they're open for business?
That was the first response the shop owners found for this law, because the law bans billboards and also even the windows should be clean. Big banks like Citibank and big stores like Dolce & Gabbana, they started painting themselves with very strong colors like yellow, red, deep blue, and creating like visual patterns to associate the brand to that pattern or to that color. For example, Citibank's color is blue. They're painting the building in very strong blue so people can see that from far away, and they can make an association with that deep blue and Citibank.
Now, the city has said, having undertaken this effort, it will eventually create zones where some outdoor advertising will be permitted. Do you expect São Paulo eventually to just revert to its previous clutter?
Not to revert the previous clutter, but I think like very specific zones. I think they're going to isolate the electronic billboards in those areas in the financial center. I don't think they should put that in residential areas as we had before.
Now, the advertising industry is obviously not happy about this. They're complaining that they're deprived of free speech and that it's costing them jobs and revenue. But is there anyone else in São Paulo who's unhappy about this? Tell me about the public at large. What's their view?
It's amazing because people in the streets are strongly supporting that. The owner of the buildings, even they have to renovate the building, they are strongly supporting that. It's a massive campaign to improve the city. The advertisers, they complain, but they agree with the ban. What they say is that we should have created criteria for that to organize the chaos.
Vinicius, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Vinicius Galvão is a reporter for Folha de São Paulo.
Coming up, ever wonder about the origins of those horrible ceiling tiles over your head? Up next, the history of sound management and a sound installation at the Paper of Record.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world. The William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Hello. By the time you hear this, OTM producers Jamie York, Megan Ryan, and I will be in Beijing, preparing stories about journalists who break the rules once they can figure out what they are, and the burgeoning consumer culture where the media are training a new generation how to spend. If you're interested in some early dispatches, pictures, and video about our progress and our process, go to our website at onthemedia.org. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. We're back with this week's show about spaces. Spaces can be constructed with bricks or mortar or sound. Princeton University professor Emily Thompson studies the history of sound, whether in a newsroom, an office building, a concert hall, or the street outside your window. What we hear in our daily lives, our soundscape, is an evolving product of technological innovations, architectural methods, and even the culture at large. In her book, The Soundscape of Modernity, Thompson charts this evolution. Emily, welcome to the show.
Thanks for taking the time to talk with me.
Throughout the course of the last two centuries, the sound landscape has changed pretty dramatically. For one thing, I guess it's gotten louder, hasn't it?
It's hard to answer that question because until a noise meter was invented, we don't have sort of a standard measure by which we can compare the level of loudness in the world today with, say, what it was 200 years ago. But I think you're right. With the development of modern technologies, industrial technology, suddenly the noise of machinery really kind of overpowers the noise of human life and natural life. And certainly in early 20th century America, with subways and subway excavation and skyscrapers being built into the sky and the noise of trucks and cars, whether it's louder or not, people respond to it differently because of the kind of noise that it is.
Now, you wrote about Symphony Hall and you've written about Radio City Music Hall, and these are the convergence between acoustics and architecture. They're magnificent buildings in addition to being acoustically advanced. There is another innovation which I connect with the 50s, but which persists like a cold sore, and that is the acoustical tile. You like the acoustical tile?
Well, I appreciate it. The acoustical tile was a very different kind of physical artifact when it first appeared, sort of in the 1920s and 1930s, when American culture is really kind of obsessed with the notion of efficiency. And industrial psychologists did experiments that proved that when people were exposed to unnecessary noise, their productivity went down. So there was a particular desire in work settings to find sound-absorbing materials that would get rid of the unnecessary noise. And the materials out of which acoustical tiles were made were some of the most sound-absorbent materials around. And the tiles fit with the architectural aesthetic at the time. It was a high-tech solution to a problem that was considered both pervasive and serious. But our attitudes towards sound change over time. And, you know, today, you know, they, in the worst case, characterize what we call the sick building syndrome. And everything that was a solution to problems back in the 20s and 30s is now a problem itself.
Well, sure, because they didn't realize that they were sucking the very souls from their lives.
And many of those tiles, unfortunately, were packed full of what was considered a miracle substance in the 20s, asbestos. We've learned a lot since then.
Now, we've talked about the volume of the soundscape and trying to deaden or obliterate the soundscape. There's one other category that fascinates me, and that is trying to alter it, whether in a shopping mall or an elevator where easy listening music is wafting in the background, or in a casino where they, I'm told, pipe in the sounds of slot machines. Are there many examples of adding sound to an environment in order to change the mood of the people within it?
Well, this is another technology that actually goes back to the 1920s, because it seems that as soon as people created those soundproofed, silenced rooms, they were a little too quiet for comfort, and they began immediately to think about how to pipe sound back into those spaces. And the origins of Muzak actually come from this period as well. The original Muzak was a technology for piping music into workspaces, and the intention was to manipulate the energy level of the workers to try to obtain maximum productivity out of them, so that maybe in the morning when they had their energy stored up, you might actually have calming music so that they'd start at a more moderated pace that they could sustain throughout the day. So it was all about productivity and efficiency. But at some point, as we became people defined more by what we bought rather than what we made, Muzak was really kind of reformulated as a commodity that could be piped into the spaces of consumption. A lot of stores use the music to kind of help create the lifestyle image they're trying to promote through their merchandise. I've also heard of more insidious uses of store sound. I don't know if they're true or not, but I'm told that some of the stores that focus on sort of adolescent clothing will play really loud, really current music, which is not only intended to attract the teenagers, but to keep the parents out of the store so that they'll just turn over the credit card and let the kid loose.
Well, in fact, there was a case in East Lansing, Michigan, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, where a guy didn't like the college kids hanging out on his street corner, so he piped classical music to the corner. and sure enough, they scattered. I want to ask you one final thing, because we've been talking about the sound environment, and we are in a period of environmentalism. And sound is on the laundry list of pollutants that some people are just trying to obliterate. Can you explain the phenomenon?
In the 1970s, which was another period where there was kind of an organized movement against noise, it was characterized as noise pollution. And we seem to kind of be experiencing a resurgence of some of those ideas today. And the recent case about the musicians in the Bavarian Orchestra, their conductor chose not to perform a newly commissioned piece because the sound level was detrimentally loud and was damaging the musician's hearing, is an interesting, unusual example of a more general problem, which is protecting workers from overexposure to loud sounds.
It seems intuitive that there's an entire generation or two of rock music fans who would go to live performances and leave not being able to hear a thing. Has there been any long-term effect to the baby boomer generation and subsequent ones from constant exposure to, you know, entertainment?
I've noticed there is an increasing number of ads for hearing aids appearing in general interest magazines now, and they're sort of marketing them as a hip, new, cool technology, which seems to be what the boomers like to do. When something becomes necessary for them, they make it cool, and then it's not so bad.
Emily, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Emily Thompson is a professor of history at Princeton University and author of The Soundscape of Modernity.
Last fall, I visited the new New York Times building in Manhattan, where an exhibit in the building's lobby recreated the lost sounds of newsrooms past using the technology of the past. Technology's always been part of the news business, ever since movable type. Some might argue since the invention of the quill. But the technology keeps changing. And in our lifetimes, we've heard it change from this to this. The spanking new New York Times newsroom.
People like to come here. They do.
David Carr covers media for the Times.
They really like to come here, but if you guys look around much, you go, well, this looks like a very nicely appointed insurance company. It's really quiet. It's kind of churchy. And like, if you ever really lose it and start screaming your head off, which you're not really a newsman, if you don't, you're really going to stick out.
The process of making the newspaper used to be filled with sound.
Artist Ben Rubin.
There was the clatter of typewriters in the newsroom itself. There were the sounds of all the machinery from the teletype machines that would clank away with the incoming news from the wire services, to the linotype machines that were slamming away, manipulating hot lead to make these printing plates, and then the printing presses themselves, which at a certain time of the night would kick in and start to rumble and shake the building, and you could smell it, you could hear it, you could see it.
You can no longer smell it, hear it, or see it. In fact, it's so quiet in the newsroom that the Times has had to figure out a way to mask that silence. They've done so using something called pink noise, which has a sound like running water. Ben Rubin.
The room tone in this building is synthetic. There's a gentle underlying pink noise that comes from pink noise generating machines. And when there was a newsroom that was filled with typewriters banging away, they created almost a sense of privacy because there was this noise floor of that banging sound of the keys hitting the paper. And now that all that is silenced out, there's actually a need to fill that void.
That void is filled, in a way, in the lobby. In the form of a piece of art, an installation called Movable Type. What you hear are synthesized sounds of ancient typewriters, teletype machines, rotary phones. Sometimes you hear the whoosh of sonar or the fracas of buzzers. And what you see are words, thousands of them, cascading across more than 500 small gray screens hanging in columns along the long walls of the central lobby. It's a massive grid, a checkerboard of portholes into the minds of 1,000 scribes. The screens work together, offering fragments of the day's paper, the month's papers, or 150 years of papers. The words come at you in patterns. Call them scenes. Sometimes the scenes are words pulled from letters to the editor, sometimes from the obits or wedding announcements, the crossword puzzle, a dozen scenes in all. Sometimes the screens are filled with quotes from recent stories. Since you can't see them, we'll read them for you.
I don't want to belong to any club that will accept me as a member.
You can be comfortable, yet dressy.
I have no idea why we got saved and others didn't.
You have to take punishment like a dancer.
I am not a modern art aficionado.
You have to sacrifice so much to the horse.
Another scene offers the day's stories reduced to their numbers.
One idea.
5 gallon buckets worth of sulfate particles in the stratosphere.
50 years.
1% of that money.
Or questions culled from the day's news.
Can anyone really agree on the definition of shifty eyes?
How dare they kill our squirrels?
How could we be a good match if he didn't approve of my hijab?
Didn't the doorman object?
Did it have a particular smell? Like teen spirit?
What do you like about Guantanamo?
Who's a good dog?
David Carr.
I think what those guys have done downstairs brings a little of the magic and a little of the mystique. And there's part of writing that's mysterious. Who knows where it comes from? And who knows how these words fly? And I think that installation with its random aphoristic sayings kind of replicates the writing process.
The guys downstairs are New York-based artist Ben Rubin and UCLA statistics professor Mark Hansen. And they worked for about 4 years to produce Movable Type. The team, which had produced art based on data before, sat down early in the process with the designer of the Times' new headquarters, architect Renzo Piano, Ben Rubin.
Within about 30 seconds of sitting down with him, he said to me, "This piece needs to last for at least 200 years." Mm-hmm. That was really one of the very first things he said. And it's quite a challenge.
Mark Hansen has spent long hours in the lobby of the Times programming natural language processing algorithms, whatever they are, to craft the scenes. Scenes that will continue to play out long after Hansen and Rubin appear in the obits. I'm sure they won't mind I said that. It's quite an honor. They had to work in the lobby because that is where the installation will live.
Some of the pacing, the rate at which things move down the hall, we've kind of tuned based on how people walk.
Mark Hansen.
During the letters to the editor scene, the dun-dun-dun, I can't tell you how many times I've had groups of people with heavy shoes kind of fall into that same walking pattern because it's got that kind of rhythm. And so when you're sitting down there, you'll stop and you'll, as you're programming it, you'll do something and you'll see what stops them.
Piano told the artist that the work should function as a kind of organism with rhythms that mimic those of the times itself, ebbing and flowing by day.
And at night it will dream. And the dreams will be bits of text, whole articles sometimes pulled from the 150-year archives of the times, sometimes totally at random, sometimes connected to something that might have appeared in that day's paper. That will sort of be, as we all do when we dream, the piece will be kind of sifting through its recent and distant memories and sometimes making sense and sometimes not so much sense.
But movable type does more than dream the dream of the times. It depicts in ways both graceful and jarring, meaningful and nonsensical, the ocean of bits and bytes we all swim in. The tabloid headline, the radio dispatch, the billboard, the talking head, the electronic sign, the snatch of conversation overheard.
You end up with a running narrative.
David Carr.
In that sense, what those guys did downstairs, which is offering bits which are stored and recalled in ones and zeros by all of us later and assembled into some kind of comprehensible picture of the world that we live in. I think it's a really great metaphor.
And now a great newspaper has a great organism breathing and belching and occasionally screeching in its lobby. And it will change as the times does, as we all do. We can walk by without looking at it, but it will always be looking at us.
I can't sleep, and it's getting under my skin.
You won't live to see 40, I promise you.
I am disgraced. I am ashamed. I let the Navy down.
You can't keep doing this job forever in this day and age.
I am absolutely sure he never knew what hit him.
You can hear a dime drop. Absolute silence.
I don't curse. I don't yell.
You should not even ask.
I don't know what the pattern is, if there is one.
Exploration of media spaces this week, we became increasingly uncomfortably aware of how quickly the gap is closing between where we live in the physical world and the vast landscape inside our heads. It's not a new observation. We've devoted a lot of time to the addictive nature of virtual experience offered by the likes of World of Warcraft or Second Life. Way back in 2003, we talked with Rich Young, who had a jones for the massive multiplayer online game EverQuest.
At one point, I was playing it almost 8 to 12 hours a day, nonstop. On the weekends, if I wasn't sleeping, I was playing. I think the big trap is the social aspect of it. When you log in and you say, how's it going, everybody? All of your friends, everyone that's in your guild says, hi, what's up, how you doing? I got to the point where I was burning out. I was starting to lose a little bit of perspective. I realized, hey, wait a minute. This is not the path to absolution.
No path to absolution, no more than in the real world, but maybe to something else. The virtual world feels real. In fact, a study published in 2006 found that when your personal space is violated there, you'll flinch just as you would in the physical world. So there is potential for real healing. Therapists use virtual reality as safe environments in which their patients can confront phobias and stress. Just one of the advantages of virtuality. It can be safe or risky. You can be the same or someone else. It is virtually limitless. Currently, NASA is using Second Life to test collaborative technologies in hopes that someday soon, civilians will be able to use avatars to hitch a ride on real lunar road missions and help the professionals by spotting, say, unusual geologic formations. Yeah. You could go to the moon. Part of you, anyway. And because we live mostly in our heads, it might be the part that matters most.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Jason Isaac and Zach Marsh. We also had help from Nadia Zonis and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. But this week, all the music you heard in the show was by the aptly named Build Buildings. You can find out more about him on our website. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.